Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. With the 1946 opening of Owen Brennan's Vieux Carré restaurant, the Brennan family's restaurant dynasty began. Today, more than a dozen Brennan's restaurants carry on the fine dining tradition that Owen first envisioned. On this week's show, we explore what it's like to grow up Brennan. We hear from Lolly Brennan and T. Martin, the ladies at the helm of Commander's Palace. Then, Ralph Brennan reveals his personal story of saving the family's flagship establishment on Royal Street. And Dickie Brennan joins us to reminisce about how his father, Dick Brennan Sr., invented the iconic jazz brunch. It's all Brennan, all the time, on this week's Louisiana Eats. Nestled in the midst of New Orleans' Garden District, Commander's Palace has been a dining destination since 1880. In 1974, siblings Ella, Dottie, Dick, and John Brennan took over the historic property and polished it into the culinary jewel that it is today. Many renowned celebrity chefs got their start in the kitchen there, including Paul Prudhomme and Emeril Lagasse. Second-generation Brennans, cousins T. Martin and Lolly Brennan, are the caretakers of this revered restaurant today. Here's what they had to say about growing up Brennan.
Well, let's see. I think it was absolutely fabulous and wonderful. To me, there's nothing better than to have a great, big, giant family who watches over each other and cares for each other and is serious and fun all at the same time.
That was a kind of serious answer from you, but I mean, because it was just sort of rip-roaring fun, you know? We were always celebrating some occasion, just because there's so many of us, but then we had all these traditions, you know? Like, you got to come to the grown-up party when you were 16 at Aunt Adelaide's house before I lived there, and, you know, the boys got their rooster cufflinks at a certain, you know, there's all these fun traditions, and then there was the Friendship House where, I mean, we really tore it up. We had this whole little hotel behind there, and we can't even talk about some of what went on over there.
Well, you know, I bet you some people don't even remember what the Friendship House was, so explain that to us.
So on the line between Gulfport and Biloxi, on the water, Dubuis Road, I think it is, there was a restaurant called the Friendship House that our family bought in the early 60s, and then right behind it was a little hotel that had like 8 cabins originally, and then Betsy blew away 3 of them, so there was 5 cabins. So eventually, each of our families took over a cabin, depending on how many kids you had. You had a bigger cabin. They had a bigger one than us. They were the Lobster Lodge.
No, we were the Howdy House.
Howdy House. We were the Flounder Hut. You know, anyway, they always had these little names on the door. And we would go over there, and in the middle of it was a park, which we called Patty's Park after another uncle. And we had, like, all restaurant equipment in this little thing outside. So we could, you know, we could cook at a serious quantity of food. And of course, there's a beer tap and all kind of everything else. And it was just a blast.
It was like our parents used to call it adult camp.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, my fondest memories are spent at the Friendship House.
So what are your memories downtown? How you all, when you all were down on Royal Street as children, what do you remember doing? What did you love to do down there?
I mean, I went to work all the time with Mom. I mean, I just...
Starting at like what age, T?
I mean, 8. You know, 9, younger. And in the ladies' room, there was a lady, Miss Louise. And Aunt Adelaide had her always dressed in beautiful French outfit. And when I got, you know, bored with whatever thing they were trying to occupy me with, you know, with doing the little sailboats that we would do in the gutter in the courtyard or whatever, that I would go hang out with Miss Louise. But, you know, I always kind of liked the work thing. And I would just follow my mom around. But I know my aunts used to take Lally shopping.
Well, we used to do a lot of things. We'd go, my good memories are going the Mardi Gras season.
Yeah.
And Mom and Dad would come home from school and we'd have to do our homework and then we'd have to get all dressed up and we'd go down and have dinner. And then when the parade got close, we could go out on the balcony, but none of the guests were allowed on the balcony. So after we caught all of our beads, Mom would divide them up, and then we had to get up, and we had to go give them away to the other tables, the other customers. So I guess that was my first BOD shift, you know, interacting with the guests by going to give them my beads. But, no, when I was a young girl, Aunt Dottie and Aunt Adelaide and Aunt Ella and my mom, they'd go to Gus Meyer on Canal Street, and they would have a fitting room. And the sales ladies would bring them clothes to try on. Of course, there'd be martinis and things like that. And so when I was young, I got to go with them. And I would just sit in the corner with my eyes like as big as saucers watching these beautiful clothes come in, the furs, the sequins, you know, the high heels matching everything. I do love my purse to match my shoes to this day. And then after that, we would walk on down to Brennan's and meet my father for dinner.
So then you would have these lovely dining experiences on Royal Street. Mm-hmm. What were your favorite things to eat?
Well, I mean, I remember so much of it.
Yeah.
And back then, the menu evolved some. I know after Mom and Uncle Dick and Uncle John and everybody left, I think the menu did, you know, not change as much. But, I mean, I remember Chopsteak Stanley. Mm-hmm. I remember great big tomato, broiled tomatoes stuffed with spinach. Mm-hmm. I remember
baked apples
all the time. And I remember, and then the broiled grapefruit with the brown sugar on
that.
It. You know,
loved
all that stuff. We just remember, and then the great wine list, and then the eggs were just these big, plump, fabulous egg dishes that, you know, we continue with now.
I remember eating my first escargot with Aunt Adelaide. I took one bite and it went from one side of my mouth to the other side of the mouth, and then I swallowed.
So what ages were you all when the move uptown occurred? When Commander's Palace happened, how old were you?
So in 74, 73, I was 13, 14.
And I'm not going to say. I'm a little bit older.
Okay. So it's safe to say you were in your teens.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
But a bunch of us were already living near Commander's.
Uh-huh.
And so then all the Commander's traditions, which we'd all already dined at Commander's. FYI, on my 9th birthday, we did not own Commander's, and we went to eat dinner there. And Mom were there with Aunt Adelaide, my dad, and my mom. And anyway, she said, "We got a birthday present for you today." I said, "What's that?" She said, "We bought this restaurant." I looked around. And it just happened to be the day the thing closed. But it's been one hell of a present, I got to tell you.
Well, I was going to say that this has been the gift that's kept on giving, hasn't it?
A lot of work, but yes. Yes.
So. And how about you, Lolly? What?
Well, I remember going, my grandfather was in the banana business, and he used to have lunch at Commander's before the family owned the restaurant,
right,
because it was all the men from the port would come have lunch. So I remember going with my grandparents as a very young girl on occasion.
Your mother's parents.
My mother's parents. Thank you, T. Yes. But then, of course, after the family bought the restaurant, you know, each of the siblings chose different nights to work, and my dad would always work on a Friday night. Whenever I'd come into New Orleans from school or out of town, my favorite thing would get all dressed up and go to dinner at Commander's for Friday night.
Right.
And loved it, and still do.
Right.
Did you both grow up knowing that the restaurant business was going to be your life?
Lally has an interesting history. Tell him, Lally.
Absolutely not. You know, I got married really young, and I moved out of town, and had a ball for about 8 years, and then that just didn't seem to work out, and I came home and floundered around for about a year, and my dear, sweet, precious father asked me if I'd come help one day a week, and I couldn't say no. I mean, he was just such a gentleman. And then from one day a week to 2 days a week to shifts to whatever, and that's how I got into the business. I didn't intentionally at all. I had an art history degree. You know, I had no idea I was going to wind up doing this. And thank goodness he invited me to come work one day.
Well, she's such a big part of Commander's, you know, just what Commander's is to all of us who work there and everybody who comes. But believe it or not, me either. My mom's my best friend and my business mentor, but she discouraged me from going into the restaurant business. So I was going to go to law school, and last minute I switched and got an MBA, and then I went off and was working for a company out of California in real estate syndication. And when Aunt Dottie called one day and said, your mom's going to have heart surgery tomorrow, and I'm like, oy. And so driving home, I'm like, what am I doing? What am I doing trying to prove myself or whatever? I'm going to come home and, you know, I want to be with her. I don't, of course, she's now clearly going to outlive us all. But at the time, that seemed a little different. And so I came home and actually started this little food products business, you know, all of us cousins and whatnot, and then came into the restaurant business. Dickie, you know, said, come on, let's do a restaurant. And Brad and I were going to do something. So we all got together and everybody, and we went off and did Palace Cafe, you know. But my whole life, we were really near Commanders, and then Mom and Dottie moved into the house next door when they were both, you know, living in these bigger houses by themselves after Aunt Adelaide died. So it's just been just a big, big part of my life.
It seems like everybody starts off either in the kitchen or especially as busboys. So when Dad said, come help, what did he want you to do, Lolly?
Well, what I first did was work as a hostess at Mr. B's. And then from that point, I moved up to Commanders and did the banquet sales and then took on more and more responsibility from that point on. I've done no real kitchen shifts, but I've certainly washed dishes and mopped up things and, you know, cut garlic bread and done any of that kind of a thing that's needed.
And how about you?
You know, one day growing up near Commanders, all the dishwashers walked out. They were mad about something. And, you know, they call up Dickie and Nikki and all of us. And so we get all the neighborhood kids and we'd go over and do the dishes. Stuff like that happened all the time. And I spent little shifts in the restaurant. But since I had gone and done the MBA and done other stuff, when I came back, I actually did. I spent 6 months in the kitchen working under Emerald because I just wanted to do it. And I loved food, but I knew I'd never do it if I didn't do it right then. And so I was really tickled to do that. But I'll tell you, my first day, actually, it's funny, Robert Bruce, who you might know, was there, and, you know, the Emerald and everybody, and they're like, oh, here we go. So they were going to do the typical put me through the ringer like everybody, you know. Anyway, so, you know, day one, they hand me, like, two crates of live soft-shell crabs, and they just go, pull the eyes out, we'll be back in a half an hour. I'm like, really? Really? Okay, fine. So I had to pull the eyes out of the live soft-shell crabs, you know, anyway. But, you know, that kind of ribbing definitely went on.
T. Martin and Lolly Brennan of Commander's Palace, Cafe Adelaide, and so boo.
Every little kiss you give to me, I'll store in my memory chest.
When we come back from a short break, Ralph Brennan joins us to tell the story of how he and his partner Terry White became the proprietors of the Royal Street Brennans. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Ralph Brennan is one of the most prolific members of the Brennan's clan. His restaurant empire includes Ralph's on the Park, the Redfish Grill, Cafe B, Cafe Noma, and the Heritage Grill. He was not looking for another restaurant opportunity, but when the original establishment bearing the family's name became available, Ralph knew he had to do something to save the iconic Brennan's restaurant. Ralph, why are we sitting here on Royal Street today?
How much time do you have?
As much as you do.
I'm sitting here on Royal Street with you because it's where my family started. You know, they started with the Absent House on Bourbon Street, moved across the street to the Vieux Carré restaurant, put the Brennan name on that, called it Brennan's Vieux Carré. That's where breakfast at Brennan's started. But it really took off at this Royal Street location. They acquired the lease on the building in 1955, and the restaurant opened in 1956. And that's where, really, I think breakfast at Brennan's became famous. And in a sense, I think, you know, the earlier generation of my family created a meal period in that breakfast meal period, because it's not your traditional scrambled eggs, grits, and bacon.
Describe what Breakfast at Brennan's means to you.
It's a multi-hour, long meal that starts with traditional New Orleans ingredients like turtle soup and egg sardou, and finishes with like bananas foster. But I think one of the most important things that no one typically has at breakfast is some sort of alcoholic beverage. It could start with a milk punch, perhaps, or a glass of wine. And I think that adds an extra dimension to the meal period.
Give me some of your iconic landmarks, you know, of what coming here to Royal Street meant to you.
Well, what often happened when I was very young is that I was the right age for my aunts Ella and Adelaide to take me on weekends. And my parents back then were probably glad to give me up for the weekend so they could have a little peace and quiet. But I would spend time with them. They lived with my grandparents up on Eleanor Street. So I'd go over there, and then we'd come downtown, and the tradition was to go to a movie, and then they actually would take me to Woolworths. Now I'm about 7 or 8 years old when this is all happening, and they'd buy me a toy or something to play with, because we'd come back over, I'm going to say we came back over to the restaurant at 4 o'clock, and they would go to work, and then I would play. And so my memories of this building at that age were a playground. I had the free run from all the way in the attic in the third floor, all the way downstairs to the kitchen, out to the wine cellar in the back. And I used to run around and play here and, you know, interact with the staff and try not to get in any trouble. And then, you know, about 8:30 or so, we'd sit down for dinner. And I'd have dinner with my aunts and have a wonderful evening, then go back home to my grandparents' house, and then get up the next morning. My grandmother would make breakfast, and I'd spend some time with them because my aunts tended to sleep in a little bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah, your two aunts, they're something else.
They really were. Adelaide especially. I was very close with her, close with Ella also. But I had a lot of fun with Aunt Adelaide.
Well, all of us who grew up in New Orleans have memories of dining in restaurants. So you're a little boy, 7, 8 years old. What do you order for dinner at Brennan's?
I used to order Steak Diane. That was my favorite dish. I would order that, and they also had vichyssoise. And I grew up on vichyssoise, and my mother used to tell the story about a train trip that we took to St. Louis, because her brother lived in St. Louis, and we went up once to visit. And while we're on the train, we go to the dining car, and of course I asked for vichyssoise. They didn't have anything like vichyssoise on the train, so she laughed at me for that. But that's kind of what I grew up on, was vichyssoise and then Steak Diane. And although I loved Bananas Foster, my favorite was Crepes Fitzgerald, the strawberries. I've always loved strawberries, so that was the perfect dessert for me. And as I was growing up, too, I found a refrigerator where it was all stored, and I'd often just eat it cold.
So you knew all the nooks and crannies here.
As I said, I had a free run of the building, and one of my favorite places was the wine cellar, and the sommelier at the time would let me in, and, you know, I'd go look around and look at all the bottles and the labels, and had a lot of fun.
Well, when you look at the Brennan's family history, my goodness, you know, you're talking about, oh, the other restaurateurs were all so close in the community. Well, my goodness, Ralph, you're related to a huge percentage of them, aren't you?
Well, when you look at the total number of restaurants, we probably do have a pretty high percentage.
And both of your children are going to be working here.
Right. I have my son, Patrick, who's a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America. And he's a cook in the kitchen with Chef Slade Rushing. And my daughter, Catherine, loves the dining room. She's wonderful on the floor, and she'll be out there in the restaurant working with the other management team.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me proud that they want to continue the tradition, and both of them have done well, and they both work hard. I guess they've seen me work hard throughout the years, and they know what it takes to be successful in this business. Because it's really not a business, it's a lifestyle. And, you know, it's exciting to me. And what's fun is to, you know, watch my son cook and do it well, and then watch my daughter interact with customers on the floor, because she's worked with us at Ralph's in the Park and Redfish Grill. I've moved her around to give her some training. And, you know, she's just a natural. And so it's fun to watch him do that. And it makes me proud as a dad.
Yeah, you should be. It's fantastic. Yeah. I look forward to seeing the next generation of Brennan's here, too. It's so wonderful that you recognize that someone else with another name might suddenly own this iconic pink building. And that, I guess, is one of the things that originally spurred you into action.
Well, sort of. But what happened is I had someone come to me at a social event and say, you need to talk to your cousin Ted. He needs some help. And so I reached out to Ted. We had lunch at the Rib Room and had a second lunch at the Rib Room. And, you know, I tried to begin a dialogue to try to help them in any way. I had no interest in Brennan's. You know, they'd had it for roughly 40 years and seemed to be doing pretty well until the last few years. And we talked for almost 2 years off and on. And then there came a point where it became obvious that they were going to lose the restaurant. And that's when I stepped in and said, "Look, I need to do something here to try to keep it in the family." And it appeared no other family members were that interested. So, you know, Terry White was looking at it also, and you know, Terry knew of my interest, I knew of his interest, and so we decided it would be best to form a partnership, and that's what we did.
So you formed this partnership, and you acquire the building. But the building didn't have a name for a long time because the name didn't go along with the building. So how did it feel when that must have been a very interesting day? Because once again, it took another trip to court to get the rights to your own last name here on Royal Street.
Yes, we did buy the building in May of 2013. And it really wasn't until July of 14 that we were able to acquire the name through the bankruptcy court. We had plan B and C and hoped that we would never have to use them because there was nothing better than to get the Brennan name and get it back on the building. And we did have several appearances in court, and finally we were able to get it. And it was a very emotional day for me because, I mean, I knew that really completed the circle, and we were able to bring, you know, we'd be bringing Brennan's back. We were well along in the renovation. We had all these great ideas that we were executing, but it would have been something different without the name.
It sure would have been. It's interesting to me, too, that part of what you acquired were the recipes. And that, I'd like to hear a little bit about that as somebody who writes cookbooks and is obsessed with recipes, and you can't copyright a recipe. So I'm not even quite sure how you own a recipe. So how did the recipes go along with the name?
Well, they really didn't. The court said we could have the recipes, but no one gave us any recipes. What we really got was a key to the door, and that's about it. You know, we obviously were able to get the logo, the rooster, things like that, but really no recipes came along with it. So what we've used, I've gone back to both of the cookbooks. There was the original cookbook that Ella and the family wrote in 19, I believe it was beginning around 1960. And then Ted and Ellen, Pip and Jimmy, they all wrote a cookbook. I forget the publication date, but within the last 10 or 15 years. So we've used both of those books to look at the recipes. And when we've done some research online, but we, you know, we kind of knew what the dishes looked like. You know, this is a very special place to me. It's a very special place to my family. And as I said earlier, I'm really starting to recognize how special it is to the rest of the community. And so that's, it's humbling, but it also scares the hell out of me. Because, you know, people will be coming back. And you know, we're going to have to live up to all of their expectations. And that'll be quite a challenge, but I think we're up to the task. And, you know, I just hope that it continues for another generation or two. And I don't know if I can worry about it after that, but
you were born for this job, Mr. Brennan. Don't worry.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. You know, it's a place I grew up. I have very, very fond memories of being here as a child. And one memory I'll tell you about is a microphone in front of me just like this. There was a lady, Jill Jackson. I don't know if you ever heard about her, but she used to do a radio show. And again, one of those early years, probably before I was 10, and my Aunt Adelaide and I were having dinner, and I think my parents were with us too that night, but she stuck me at Jill's table, and Jill stuck a microphone And I didn't say a word. I was so terrified.
Well, I'm glad you so, got over that.
Yes, I did. But boy, for a little kid and a microphone, and it was a terrifying experience for me. But it's a memory I still have and I think about often.
Well, since you brought up Aunt Adelaide again, I'd be remiss without asking you for the ages to tell us the magical high school date that Aunt Adelaide helped arrange here at Brennan's for you.
Yeah, that was quite a night. My aunt had a very close friend, and they were trying to get me to date and get to know this lady's niece. And so it was two aunts helping their nephew and their niece get together, and we had a wonderful dinner. And after dinner, they got us up, and they took us to the front door and walked us outside of the street, and there was a carriage. And there was a bottle of champagne, and they told the driver, don't come back until the bottle's empty. And so we rode around the corner and had a wonderful, magical evening.
That's a magical and, high school date.
It is, you know, and probably, you know, we were underage, too, as I recall. But, you know, that's New Orleans, and nothing ever came of it. We had a wonderful time. We still see each other every once in a while, and it's a great memory.
Ralph Brennan of the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group. Only in New Orleans does breakfast begin with a creamy cocktail and end with a flaming dessert. The tradition of breakfast at Brennan's dates back to the 1950s. Owen Brennan, the patriarch of the Brennan clan, challenged his sister Ella to create a flaming dessert utilizing the bananas that had just begun pouring into the port of New Orleans from South America. Together, Ella and Dutch chef Paul Blanger created Bananas Foster and named it for their friend, Robert Foster of the Foster Awning Company. Little did they know that over 50 years later, Bananas Foster would be the most famous flaming dessert in the world. Before Brennan's closed briefly in 2013, Chef Lazone Randolph was the executive chef, the last one to have learned how to make Bananas Foster from Chef Paul Blanger himself. We had an opportunity to talk with Chef Lazone about the iconic dish and his lifelong career at the historic Brennan's Restaurant.
Chef Lazone, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hi, Poppy. How are you?
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here in this beautiful room. Thanks so much for talking to us. Now, how long have you worked here for the Brennan's family?
I've been here 46 years working for the Brennan's family. You know, when I came here, it was one of my dreams, one of my ambitions. I didn't know I would be here this long, I tell you that. But here I am today that I'm still working here, and I still enjoy working for the Brennan's family because we are family here.
So as far as I know, you are one of the very last Creole chefs in the city to have worked your way up to the position of executive chef in such an important establishment like Brennan's. Tell me, what did you start doing here?
Well, when I started at the bottom, and I worked my way up to the top. I met a lot of great people along the way. And then I met the Brennan's family, Mr. Ted, Mr. Jimmy, Mr. Pip, and all those people were important in me being developed into what I am. I mean, they took the time to help me, show me, train me, give me wine, give me this, give me that. Every time they would go around the world somewhere, they would bring me a book or saying, look at this, study this, or whatever. So this is where, and then I was in Dallas, Texas for 5 years when Brennan's was expanding. And then after the family had a little problem, I came back here. And I came back here in 1974. And I've been back here ever since. Chef Mike was the executive chef before I was, and he passed. And I was next in line, I guess, to say, because I had been here and I knew the tradition of Brennan's, I knew everything about Brennan's, I knew the customers, I knew the clientele, I knew everything about Brennan's. So this is why when it came to me to become an executive chef, I thought about it. And then After I thought about it, then it was presented to me when I had a meeting with the Brennan's family. They offered it to me, and I accepted it, and here I am today.
Well, I am so glad that you're here. Mm-hmm. And that 35,000 banana number that mm-hmm. I quoted, that was just for the Bananas Foster. Now, I think it's very interesting that there's another Bananas dish on the menu that's a savory dish. Would you tell us about that one?
You're talking about the Filet Stanley. When I came here, I found that dish on the menu. And it's a filet mignon, sauteed bananas with a creamy horseradish sauce. And it's topped with a little mushroom sauce on top of the steak. That's a very interesting dish. And that dish has withstood time to stay on Brennan's menu for years and years and years. And people come here when they want to, you know, taste something different in the line of a steak. I tried it. I had a chef dinner here. And that was one of the things that I put on the menu. And the combination of the beef, the sauteed banana, the horseradish, it's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. When I tasted it for the first time, the whole thing just surprised me. It was shocking, really. Now, let's get back to those Bananas Foster. What's the secret of the Bananas Foster?
My secret to Bananas Foster is ripe bananas. You need a banana that's beginning to spot and is ripe and is sweet. The natural sugar of the banana is beginning to come out of the banana and stuff like that. I mean, it's the premier dish of this restaurant, Bananas Foster. Everybody come here, they want to finish their meal with a Bananas Foster. So it's really an important part of this restaurant.
Do you think you could show us how to make Bananas Foster?
It would be my pleasure. It would be my pleasure to show you how to make the world famous Bananas Foster. All right. The secret to doing Bananas Foster is these are the ingredients. We got butter, sugar, cinnamon, and banana liqueur. And ripe bananas, of course. You need bananas that's really beginning to start spotting a little bit, where the bananas are really starting to ripen, where the sweetness of the banana is coming out. And then you start sauteing those bananas down until you cook them. And when you start cooking all these ingredients together, you're going to see your sugar start to caramelize. And once the sugar caramelizes, and you know, you can see where it's caramelized, then you can flambe it with white rum. We use a white rum to do these bananas because, I mean, we don't need a flavored rum because the flavors are here already with all the other ingredients. And then we flambe this dessert with the white rum and serve it over vanilla ice cream. And only vanilla ice cream is what we use at Brennan's restaurant. Only. This is the way the dessert was created. And all the years that it's been here, we have maintained the quality of this dessert with vanilla ice cream. Thank you very much.
Chef Lasone Randolph. What is the trick to poaching a perfect egg? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
If you want it, the star that shines so brightly, to match the star that's in your eye, darling, I would chase that bright star nightly.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is the trick to poaching a perfect egg? First, use the freshest eggs possible. Fresh eggs from farmers markets are guaranteed to perform the best. In a saucepan or skillet, bring about 2 inches of water to a low simmer. That means a few tiny bubbles are the only evidence of a slight boil. You'll want the water to be about 160 to 180 degrees. If the water's too cool, the yolk will separate from the white before it cooks. If the water's too hot, the whites will be tough. Add a bit of vinegar to the water. The vinegar helps the egg whites to coagulate. Then, add the egg to the water. Some people use a cup to ease it in. Immediately use a spoon to gently roll the egg in the water until you see it forming up into an oval egg shape. Depending on how soft or firm you want your egg, poach it for 3 to 5 minutes. Use a slotted spoon to remove the egg from the water and serve immediately. Don't be afraid. I have to admit that this one bit of egg cookery intimidated me for quite a while, but now it's one of my favorite things to do. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. When Owen Brennan was the proprietor of Brennan's restaurant, in between service meals, he would ask Chef Paul Blanger to prepare his lunch. Usually, he ordered Eggs Benedict. Chef Blanger noticed that before Owen left the kitchen, he would grab a spoonful of veal demi-glace and ladle it over his hollandaise sauce. That inspired the chef to create his own dish, which they called Eggs Hussard. During the time of the Napoleonic War, the Hussards were brave Prussian military men known to only eat red meat. True confession, when I have breakfast at Brennan's, I always have the Eggs Hussard. For a copy of Brennan's recipe for Eggs Hussard, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org or itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Eggs Hussard are real Louisiana Eats. We were fortunate enough to sit down with Dickie Brennan Jr. to hear his story of growing up Brennan. Dickie witnessed firsthand the transition his father made in moving from Brennan's on Royal Street to transforming Commander's Palace into a New Orleans institution. Here, Dickie shares childhood memories of his father and how Dick Brennan Sr.'s innovation led to the creation of the Jazz Brunch. Dickie, I am so thrilled to have this opportunity to sit back with you and look back in time. I'm curious, do you have any childhood memories of eating at the Brennan's on Royal Street?
Oh, absolutely. Dad worked Sundays because that was the busy breakfast. You know, Sunday breakfast was huge at Brennan's. And Aunt Ella, being the older sister, she liked Saturday. She liked being in the restaurant Saturday nights. And so little brother worked those breakfasts, you know. And as I got older, I'd go down with him. And, you know, I'd hang out up in the office, which was a funny office up in the attic. I'd go play out in the patio because they had the fountain that the water ran down this gutter, I guess, right in the courtyard and went all the way to the carriage house where the front door would be, and we would float the little wooden stir sticks. Then he'd sit me at a table, and I'd get an egg dish sent to me, and, you know, sometimes he'd come sit down with me. Other times I'd just sit there and eat by myself, but I have vivid memories of being with my dad for breakfast on occasion. And then in the 70s, our family split up the business. And Dad and Ella, my Uncle John, and my Aunt Adelaide and Aunt Dottie moved to Commander's. And the oldest brother, Owen, his three sons, Jim, Ted, and Pip, stayed at the original Brennan's. And so my dad and his brothers and sisters moved from their flagship, which was, you know, something they built into being a very successful business, into Commander's, which had become very run down over the years and didn't know if they were going to be able to pay the light bills. So I certainly walked in as a teenager or was exposed to them having a lot of stress and trying to figure out what they were going to do to turn this old gem back into something, you know, that could thrive.
Well, your very earliest memories must be filled with restaurant dining and delicious food.
You know, Poppy, we moved into the house I grew up in, I guess, in 69. I was 9 years old. And maybe right after that, we bought Commander's Palace, which was two blocks away. So, yeah, my playground was Commander's Palace, which was pretty awesome being a 10, 11-year-old kid. So, that was where I hung out most days.
Great after school treats, I imagine.
Boy, I tell you, they, you know, they create. I remember they created a dish called Baby Veal Lafayette, and I just fell in love with it. And I'd go eat about two or three of them, and they'd kind of tell, back or down, buddy. You know, I mean, that was young kid starving after school. I mean, that was my snack. Yep. Two or three Baby Veal Lafayettes.
That sounds pretty, pretty wonderful. By that time, you're in middle school and getting into high school, and it's in the Brennan good Irish work ethic. It's time for you to go to work, huh?
Absolutely. You know, my dad's generation, they got into the business and really had no background in the restaurant industry. And the one thing, as they really educated themselves over the years, the one thing that none of them did was cook. I mean, they studied and learned as much as they could about food, and I think they developed incredible palates when it came to tasting foods. But none of them actually cooked. And so I was interested as a kid, and my dad really encouraged me to do it because he felt like that's something, you know, he never could step in and actually do that.
You know, I don't know that people completely appreciate the role of the restaurateur in the creative end of the kitchen.
Right.
Because I think a lot of people would think that it's the chef. The chef is in there with the big, brilliant ideas, dreaming things up. But it's collaborative, isn't it?
It is. You know, food development can come from anybody. And it's not, you know, it's tough when you're the chef and all the pressures to have to do everything yourself. I think some of the best dishes come out of collaboration. In fact, Paul Prudhomme told me one time, he says, did I ever tell you what your dad did to me with bread pudding souffle? And I'm like, no. He said, man, it was a busy, busy dinner at Commander's. And he says, I was working the line, and we were just really going down. And your dad walks in the back all the way on the line with me and comes up, whispers in my ear. He says, Paul, let's make a great dessert. Let's do a bread pudding souffle. And he said, first he's like, geez, Dick, I'm trying to get us out of the weeds here. Can we talk later? And he's like, well, sure. But he said he couldn't stop thinking about it. And in fact, as soon as the shift was over, he went home and kind of just wrote out kind of a recipe for it. And it was just real simple. It just came to him right away. He went in the restaurant first thing the next morning, pulled one together, let him try it, and it was history.
That's incredible.
My dad, you know, I talk about walking from our home to Commander's. He also walked into Paul one day. He says, Paul, I walk to work every day, and I step on pecans. He says, but I've never stepped or seen an almond tree in New Orleans. Why do we do trout almondine when we could be doing trout pecan? And that's when we created at Commander's trout pecan. And
that's brilliant.
Yeah, you know. What amazes me is trout almondine has been on our menu for hundreds of years. Why pecans weren't used when they're our local, you know, we were a port city, so we had products that came in. But, wow, that one was long overdue.
That's a great one. Well, you were part in high school of another landmark occasion for New Orleans food. Would you tell us the story of the birth of the New Orleans Jazz Brunch? How did your dad get this idea?
I guess it was like 73 or 4. No, it's probably 74. And if 20 people came by on a Sunday after church, that was the brunch crowd at Commander's Palace.
Wow. So, must have been empty and lonely in there.
Well, here was a guy that was going every Sunday of his life, you know, for 20 years, taking care of 1,000 people at breakfast at Brennan's, to 20 people showing up if that was going to happen. And, you know, we had gone to Europe. It was back when getting the Ural Pass, and you would take the trains through 10 countries in Europe. And my dad wanted to take my sister and I. So my mother and father, the four of us, flew over and literally hopped on trains and got off and found little hotels or wherever in all these different countries. And it was while we were there. He saw some musicians, and he just, I guess it came to him, I want to put music in in the dining room. It's New Orleans. It's jazz. Let's put music and food together in the dining room. So he did. He called, you know, I guess he was calling just to check in, see how things were going. And he told Aunt Ella on the phone, he says, I've got a great idea. I want to do jazz brunch at, you know, at Commander's. And she was like, sure, whatever, whatever. Come on home. Quit playing. Come on home. And so Dad called up Alvin Acorn, who was a great jazz musician locally, and said, Alvin, can you come by with a couple of people? I want you to just play some nice jazz music in the dining room. I don't want a stage. I don't want you, you know, stand. I want you to walk around the dining room, you know. So here we were, and it was the Saturday before the first Sunday, and someone had done an etching of the facade of Commander's. So it had that unique with the sign that hangs out over Washington Avenue. And so it was that picture, and it said, take the streetcar to the historic Garden District, Jazz Brunch, Commander's Palace. And literally ran off copies up in the office there. And my sister and I got on a streetcar and went down to the French Quarter. And we walked around Jackson Square, believe it or not. And we passed out these pamphlets all Saturday. And we wake up Sunday morning. You know, my dad wakes me up, and I'm putting on my busboy outfit. You know, I had the black pants and the white shirt and the bow tie and polished shoes. Always had to have polished shoes. And we were walking to the restaurant, you know, early morning to go set it up. And he asked me, he said, how many people you think we're going to do? I was like, I don't know. I mean, I was a teenager. I'm like, I don't know. And he kept pushing me. I said, I hired 100 people. And he's like, well, that would be good. All right. Well, at 200 people, we closed the doors. It just, I guess we did a good job of passing out the pamphlets. But I can remember, you know, we were little kids, and the people who would stop, and they'd say, well, what you got? And we'd describe it. They'd go, wow. And I mean, think about it. You're in the French Quarter. Yeah. You get to it's a reason to take this incredible streetcar that's been around forever. You go into one of the most historic neighborhoods outside of the French Quarter in New Orleans to a wonderful old neighborhood restaurant that had been there almost 100 years old to go listen to music, jazz music, and have brunch.
It's a magical
mixture.
That
sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
It sounds fantastic. It was
so I guess
a
we had an
mixture.
Easy sell, Lauren and I, but I don't know. That's how it laid out, and it's an honor for me that I was able to witness or participate to the extent I did, and to see how it's become such a tradition in this city, you know. And I've always looked up to my dad. He's got incredible vision, and you know, things that he's come up with have been amazing. But that's just kind of, you know. That's him.
Creating the jazz brunch is quite a legacy. And yeah. What a special thing for you to have that clear memory of high school age Dickie Brennan in his busboy's uniform, walking to work with Dad, getting ready to launch the brunch that changes the world, the jazz brunch.
Absolutely. It's a great memory. And I walked from that house on 3rd Street to Commander's many, many times with my dad over the years. And that certainly was one of the better times we walked together.
Dickie Brennan Jr., son of the late Dick Brennan Sr. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickie Brennan & Company.
Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producer Chris Kehoe and associate producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.